I know you're disappointed, he said. I am too. I know I should have stopped him and called the police. Margaret stared up at the sliver of moon. She was silent. All I can say is that at the time, I was toxically drunk and in some sort of shock. And when I finally understood what had happened, the thought of leaving you and the baby on your own seemed atrocious. That's not an excuse, and it makes me sound as if I think I'm some selfless hero, but you have to believe it's not like that at all. I am disgusted with myself. I'm actually bothered about something else more than that, she said. Uh-oh, thought Charlie. Jesus, I shouldn't have told her. How did you drive the car? Margaret asked. Charlie was taken aback. What do you mean? She turned around and faced him, standing in the doorway. You were blackout drunk. Strongfellow told you later that you were knocked out.
Right.
Charlie, you don't just shake off that sort of thing and go drive. That's not you. You go full coma. You're impossible to wake up from something like that. I can't even get you to stop snoring. And that's from mere martinis. Forget absinthe.
What are you saying?
I'm saying I don't think you were driving the car. I don't think you killed that young woman.
And then La Montaigne just happens along, and now you're indebted to him? I mean, really?
Charlie looked at her eyes, as clear and green as emeralds, her expression as sincere as a child's. She meant this, and in her certainty, he began to believe it might be true. It hadn't even been a full week since the crash, but it felt like 6 months. He'd carried the guilt of that night with him as a constant companion. The thought that he might not have been responsible was something he barely allowed himself to consider, to hope for. He started to offer a protest, but Margaret, silhouetted in the doorway, silenced him with a stern shake of her head.
There's just no one who knows you like I do, Charlie, and I'm telling you that you weren't responsible for that car crash. Not for any moral or ethical reason. I mean just pure metabolism.
She re-entered the room and shut the motel door behind her.
I think it was all a setup, she said.
At 9 that morning, Isaiah Street's 1952 Green Plymouth Cranbrook pulled up in front of their motel room, its brakes screeching and gravel spraying. Charlie had called him a few hours earlier. He knew it was a big favor to ask, but he believed that Street had some idea of how high the floodwaters were rising around him, a sense confirmed when Street immediately agreed. The martyrs were waiting and ready when Street arrived, giving him no need to honk or even turn off the car as they climbed inside, Charlie up front, Margaret in the back. Street nodded his appreciation.
No reason for someone like me to be in one place for too long in rural Maryland, he said dryly, as he made a U-turn out of the parking lot and got back on rural Route 32, keeping 5 miles an hour under the speed limit, as always.
I'm guessing you went faster as a Tuskegee Airman, Margaret joked.
All I had to worry about up there was the Luftwaffe, Street said.
Street turned the radio dial to news. The statehoods of Hawaii and Alaska were being put on a single Senate bill against the wishes of the Eisenhower administration.
Why does he want them separate? Asked Margaret.
Hawaii's a Republican state. Alaska's Democratic, Charlie said. Ike is more keen on adding the Republican voters and senators to the rolls. More news from the Marshall Islands. The Atomic Energy Commission was about to acknowledge that more than 24 Americans and hundreds of natives had been exposed to radiation during the recent testing of an atomic bomb. Next, stunningly, the Army had issued a report charging that McCarthy and Cohn had threatened the military if it didn't provide preferential treatment for one of their former investigators, Private David Shine. McCarthy and Cohn had wanted Shine to get an expedited promotion and be stationed at West Point with a cushy job. After those requests were denied, Cohn threatened to wreck the Army, sources said.
What a little creep, Margaret said. Attack, attack, attack. Threaten, threaten, threaten. How did Cohn make it to adulthood without learning how civilized people behave?
Civilized people such as whom? Asked Charlie. Such as Joe McCarthy?
Him too, Margaret said. This is not normal.
Street chortled. Speak up, Isaiah, Charlie said. You're among friends.
I'm sorry, but the things commonly said about Negroes, not only in polite company, but on the floor of the House and Senate, you don't know what being uncivilized is. Imagine a world full of Cones and McCarthys accusing all people with your skin color of every crime imaginable. Of being subhuman. Not for our ideology, not for being a red, whether true or not, but for how we were born. Imagine statues of these accusers lining the halls of Congress. I mean, my people have been facing McCarthyism since before McCarthy. Are you now, or have you ever been, a Negro?
He shook his head and silence filled the car.
It's a fair point, Margaret finally said. These are the things I typically don't say in front of white folks.
Another silence. Charlie looked toward the back seat to Margaret, who smiled at him regretfully. I suppose there are no secrets among us anymore, Charlie said.
I would hope not, said Street.
He looked at Margaret in the rearview mirror.
Your husband told me all about the predicament in which he finds himself.
That's right, Charlie said. You're the only two who know everything.
Not everything, Margaret noted. Tell Isaiah about New York, about McCarthy's request.
So Charlie told Isaiah about McCarthy's menacing demand that Charlie obtain the Strongfellow file from his father's study, and that he'd complied. Street drove them through the rural hills of Maryland, which, though they were only 90 minutes or so from Baltimore and 2 hours from Washington, D.C., looked like they could have been in Alabama or Indiana. A small town would pop up around a turn, pharmacy, diner, doctor's office, hardware store, gas station, school, then quickly vanish after 2 blocks, the landscape going back to forests or farms. They sped by immense empty fields where corn would soon grow, roadside produce markets advertising asparagus, tomatoes, and squash that did not yet exist. As they rode, they discussed the murky swamp in which Charlie had found himself waiting.
I think for now you've got to go along to get along while we figure out what to do next, Street said. Maybe you can cease to be of any use to them? Get a new committee assignment? Instead of appropriations, maybe try to get on Veterans Affairs? God knows it should be easy enough to get a seat, not exactly a meal ticket committee assignment.
Margaret lit a cigarette and rolled down the window. Wearing black sunglasses and a sheer scarf wrapped around her head, she looked like a movie star trying not to be recognized.
Let's just try to keep a low profile, though, Charlie, she said. You don't need to be going out to cocktail parties or poker nights. Just go to work and come home.
I agree with that, except the poker night part, Street said.
Me too, Charlie said grimly. Charlie sank in his seat. Street found a jazz station on the radio, and none of them spoke until the car crossed the brand new Chesapeake Bay Bridge, which, at 4.3 miles, was the third longest bridge in the world. The structure seemed endless to Charlie, and there was part of him that hoped they might never have to return to land. Chapter 21. Tuesday, March 16th, 1954. Washington, D.C. When Charlie met Cohn at Filibuster's on Constitution Avenue the following Tuesday, the lawyer stood and greeted him with a smile, then sank back into the leather club chair at the corner table and summoned another Manhattan with a word and a flick of his hand in the direction of the bar. Charlie placed the manila folder containing NBC's dirt on Strongfellow in the center of the table.
You take a peek? Asked Cohn.
No.
Cohn rolled his eyes while he lit a lucky strike. Need a towel there, Pontius?
He opened the folder and inspected its contents.
They were sitting below framed faded photographs of once powerful legislators whose names might prove elusive to anyone but the most devoted student of congressional arcana.
While Cohn read the NBC memo about Strongfellow, Charlie glanced idly at the men on the wall. He thought of the Howard Chandler Christie painting of the signing of the U.S. Constitution, about how only 3 or so of the delegates might be recognizable even to members of Congress.
Will anyone know about me? He wondered.
His congressional career to date would hardly merit a spot on even a monument to obscurity. The waitress brought Cohn's Manhattan and took Charlie's drink order.
You have no interest in what I'm reading? Cohn asked without looking up,
his eyes keenly focused on whatever incriminating information lay before him.
Of course I'm interested, said Charlie. That doesn't mean I think it's my business. And Strongfellow's a friend.
Friend, Cohn said. You're a sweetie pie.
Why do you need dirt on Strongfellow? Charlie asked.
Cohn closed the folder.
We need to know what's out there about him so we can protect him, he said. If NBC Entertainment knows damaging information about a congressman, then NBC News might report it. They probably won't, but still. Strongfellow's on the team. We need to be prepared to protect him.
Protect him? He was in the OSS and can barely stand because of the injuries he sustained at the hands of the Nazis. If there's a tougher son of a bitch in Congress, I have yet to meet him.
Cohn barked a short laugh.
For a professional historian, you're pretty gullible. I wouldn't believe everything This Is Your Life tells you.
You think I'm a gullible historian? Charlie attempted a smile.
Maybe it's a good thing I've changed careers.
Funny you'd say so.
Cohn looked at him sternly.
There are some Democrats planning to run against you, as you might expect. Your father and I spoke about setting up a campaign committee, with your permission, of course.
You spoke with my father?
Sure, Cohn responded, as if there were nothing odd about that. Carlin asked me to. You have no reelect set up.
Head down, Charlie told himself. Act like this is all fine with you.
That's a flattering offer, and I appreciate it. I haven't even officially decided if I'm running for reelection.
Cohn raised an eyebrow as the cocktail waitress deposited a glass of Jack Daniels in front of Charlie.
Why wouldn't you run? Cohn asked. Granted, a certain group of us are well aware that you have no idea what you're doing, but to the wide world out there, including most of the morons in this town, you're a comer.
I haven't even discussed it with my wife yet.
Cohn reached into the inside pocket of his jacket and withdrew his checkbook and a pen. Allow me to make the first contribution, assuming you do run, he said.
He opened the checkbook, scribbled something, and then handed Charlie a check for $500, made out to him personally.
Shouldn't this be for the Vote for Charlie Martyr Committee or something?
You can always transfer it to that committee after I have it set up for you, if you'd like me to take that step.
Head down, Charlie thought. He nodded glumly, then caught himself, smiled, and raised a glass to his new campaign treasurer as he felt his body sinking slowly into an imagined pit of ooze.
The makers of Camel cigarettes bring the world's news events right into your own living room, proclaimed the announcer, before a black-and-white film montage of a prize fight, a battleship, the U.S. Capitol building, and a bathing beauty contest. Sit back, light up a Camel, and be an eyewitness to the happenings that made history in the last 24 hours.
Renee Street never missed an episode of NBC's Camel News Caravan. She looked forward to her nightly reward after a long day spent tending to the twins, whose lives were interrupted five times a week by the sound of John Cameron Swayze's opening line, "Let's go hopscotching around the world for headlines," a Pavlovian trigger for them to remain silent and out of trouble. With a flower in his lapel and a folksy direct gaze, Swayze conveyed an air of charming authority. Renee Street was such a fan, in fact, that she had been one of the first in line at the Woodward and Lothrop department store to purchase Swayze, a news trivia board game from Milton Bradley. She might have been the wife of a congressman, but she never felt closer to the news and matters of importance than when she was playing Swayze, which was how Charlie, Margaret, Isaiah, and Renee came to be sitting around a table at the Street's house two Thursdays after Street picked up Charlie and Margaret from Polly's lodging, rolling the dice and debating whether the answers to the news quiz were correct. Isaiah was the first to raise an objection. Margaret had asked, "To which country did the U.S. send aid and manpower in the 1950s to help support democracy?"
"I know the card is going to want me to say Korea," Street said, "but there are really any number of countries that applies to. Albania, the Philippines, Germany, Guatemala," said Charlie.
"Iran," Street added.
"British Guiana," said Street.
"Vietnam."
"But he means troops," protested Renee defensively, as if John Cameron Swayze had written the questions personally. "That's why it says manpower."
"CIA are men," said her husband, "and they're in Saigon and all over."
"Poorly worded, Swayze," Charlie teased. Renee shot him a look of mock offense.
"The card does say Korea," Margaret said, "so go again."
Since returning from New York City and Nanticoke Island 2 weeks before, Charlie had done everything he could to keep his head down. He'd dutifully, if unhappily, handed the This Is Your Life investigation to Cohn, agreed to co-sponsor the farm bill with Carlin, and prepared for the comic book hearing on behalf of Kefauver. All of it filled him with regret. But there was some consolation in Margaret now knowing and understanding that this was what he had to do until they figured out some escape plan. At work, he seldom left his congressional office except for a hearing or a vote. Leopold kept close tabs on him and seemed pleased with his new attitude, as it made for fewer complications in her professional life. After discovering nothing particularly noteworthy about Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer, Bernstein retreated to her more secretarial tasks. Their banter continued, but it was less charged, more benign. He wished he could explain to her the strategy, such as it was. Charlie had retreated from D.C. socializing and was spending any and all free time with Margaret, dining or seeing movies, and twice now, staying in with the Streets.
In what town did Senator Joseph McCarthy first reveal the presence of 205 members of the Communist Party in the United States State Department? Margaret read.
The Streets conferred. Isaiah thought it was Charleston, West Virginia. Renee was certain it was Wheeling. Charlie took the card from his wife's hand and read it silently. I would note, he said, that the card suggests that McCarthy's ever-changing number of reds at state is a factual accusation when it says he revealed the presence. What should it say instead? Renee asked.
I don't know. Claimed? Invented?
You yourself have said there are communists in the government, Charlie, said Isaiah.
Of course, Charlie said. But we all know by now that McCarthy and Cohn were making up these numbers. I don't think they've actually nailed down one red in the State Department. They just concocted a story.
Don't reporters do that too? Asked Margaret.
Do they? Asked Charlie.
I don't think John Cameron Swayze makes anything up, said Renee. I read articles about the Puerto Rican guerrillas that got everything wrong, said her husband. There are a few solid reporters here and there, but it seems like too much of what's in the news media is spoon-fed to journalists by various government factions with agendas. Anti-communist, pro-GOP, pro-Stevenson, pro-McCarthy, whatever. I don't know what to believe anymore.
Not these cards, said Charlie. He lit a cigarette.
The next morning, as he walked through National Statuary Hall, Charlie noticed a small floor tile honoring James Polk, the 11th president of the United States and the only former Speaker of the House to have made it to the top job. The tile marked where Polk's desk had been from 1835 until 1839 when he was Speaker, and the House chamber was located where Statuary Hall now stood. Charlie had walked past or even on this tile countless times without giving it much thought. Now he paused to examine it. Polk was an incredibly consequential president most Americans knew nothing about, he thought. Politics was a cruel gig. Charlie's early days in D.C. had been exciting, probably too exciting, he knew, but as the novelty wore off and the realities of political life became more oppressive, he found himself missing the less flashy, more substantial work he'd left behind at Columbia. He'd loved the quiet thrills of research and discovery, and if he was being completely honest, he missed the acclaim that came with his best-selling book. He returned to his office, greeting Leopold with an absent-minded nod as he sank into the chair behind his desk. Before him sat a collection of letters and documents, as well as two books that had been sent to him, early proofs of Herman Hagedorn's The Roosevelt Family of Sagamore Hill, and the latest from his friend Paul Horgan, Great River, the Rio Grande in North American History. He sighed. What was he doing? He recalled Mac and then Margaret Chase Smith suggesting he check out the Special Members Only collection at the Library of Congress. Smith had specifically urged him to look into Ben Franklin and the Hellfire Club he had briefly mentioned in Sons of Liberty. Beyond the welcome distraction and the possibility that another book might provide him with a clearer path forward, Charlie felt excited at the prospect of research and access to rare documents. He called Margaret to tell her he'd be late getting home.
5:30, right on time, Bernstein said, looking at her watch.
She'd been waiting for him in the Jefferson Building of the Library of Congress. Above her, in the semicircle over an arched window, hovered a painting of Johann Gutenberg with two assistants at his printing press. Nearby were other painted tributes to the evolution of scholarship. A cairn, hieroglyphics, a cave painter, a monastery scriptorium. Come with me, Charlie said, not breaking stride. Over the past few months, he and Bernstein had developed an easy friendship and even an affection, and while he wanted to encourage her scholarship, he also felt the need to establish some firmer boundaries so as to avoid any misunderstandings. Bernstein, looking a bit wounded by his brusque greeting, scurried after him as he proceeded up the stairway to the east end of the Great Hall's north alcove, to the office of the Librarian of Congress.
So? She said.
So?
So? What are we up to here?
Oh, right, said Charlie, reminded that other people existed. Why are we here? Both Mac and Senator Smith told me about this members-only section of the library.
Right? And?
And Smith suggested that there might be more information about the Hellfire Club. Do you remember from my book?
Of course. Ben Franklin and his lecherous adventures in England. I'd read a whole book on that subject alone.
The problem was I couldn't find any more about the Hellfire Club when I was working on my book. I tried. Maybe this special collection will have more. In any case, I thought you'd be interested in joining me to see what they have. Charlie didn't say it aloud, but beyond his curiosity, part of him was contemplating a return to academia, and a potential project of note might ease the path back to the Upper West Side. But for now, his path was to the office of the Librarian of Congress. The previous holder of that position had left to work for the UN, and President Eisenhower had not yet nominated a replacement, so the task of escorting the congressman and his comely young aide to the members-only section of the Rare Book and Special Collections Reading Room in the Adams Building of the library fell to Stuart Sneed,
an earnest and deferential junior librarian, who soon appeared at the office of the librarian and apologized for being 30 seconds late. He walked Charlie and Bernstein down to the basement, along a long hall, and then, once they were in the Adams building, up two flights of stairs. He unlocked a heavy oak door and escorted them into the expansive Special Collections reading room, where a half a dozen scholarly types sat in silence in armchairs or at well-lit desks studying various books and documents. Sneed offered Charlie and Bernstein a cursory tour of items on display behind glass cases, the library's Gutenberg Bible, published sometime around 1454. German cartographer Martin Waldseemüller's 1507 Introduction to Cosmography, where it was first suggested that the New World be named America. Two pairs of spectacles, a pocket knife, a $5 bill, and other items President Lincoln had had on his person that fateful night at Ford's Theater.
Spooky, Bernstein said with a slight shudder.
But other than that, how was the library, Miss Bernstein? Joked Charlie. With a deferential tilt of his head, Sneed indicated that they should follow him. At another door at the far end of the room, he extracted an enormous key ring, shuffled through all the possibilities, and finally arrived at one that had been marked with red nail polish. He grinned triumphantly and inserted the key with a flourish. Opening the door created a sound of suction. The members-only collection was obviously tightly controlled for both climate and security.
"When was the last time anyone visited this collection?" Bernstein whispered.
"A couple months ago, I believe," said Sneed. "It's seldom used. Not too many members of Congress take the time to see the antiquities. If they want something from us, it usually concerns information about what's going on today, and we have a page bring whatever is needed right over." The room inside was cozy, with an ornate oriental rug, a large sofa, two plush armchairs, and wall-to-wall bookshelves and wooden file cabinets. Sneed pinballed around the room, turning on lamps, explaining how the various papers and letters in the collection were categorized, offering white cotton gloves and tweezers to Charlie and Bernstein for the handling of any document sealed in plastic. He also provided them with a binder detailing all of the various collections in the room and where they might be found.
"Library closes at 10, he said, after which he disappeared and left them to begin exploring the caverns of ancient letters in search of information about Benjamin Franklin and the Hellfire Club. They quickly found five folders of deeds, proclamations, books, drafts, newspapers, speeches, and correspondence to and from Franklin, and they divided them into two piles. 2 hours into the documents, Charlie threw his hands up in frustration.
"Still nothing?" Bernstein asked.
"No. A few mentions of his trips to England, but zero about the Hellfire Club, or the Medmenham monks, as they called themselves. I guess I should have known better than to expect something to just be sitting here waiting to be discovered." Bernstein sighed sympathetically. He'd asked her to look into the section on England in the 1700s for mentions of Sir Francis Dashwood, the founder of the Hedonistic Society. So far, all she'd found was information having to do with his duties as Postmaster General in England. Charlie stood and stretched and looked at his watch. Time to get home to Margaret. "Let's call it a night. Tomorrow we'll brainstorm about what to do next. Maybe there's something in that binder detailing all the collections that we can study in the meantime. Can you ask Sneed to make a photocopy? Pretty sure the library has a copy flow."
"A what?"
"A prototype photographic copy machine. You know, xerography."
"I have no idea what you're talking about, Congressman."
"New technology. Have you really not followed this? Halloyd Company? Xerography? Photographic copies of documents? It will be huge. You should invest in it if you have any money."
"I don't."
"Seriously, though," Charlie said, collecting his belongings. "Don't you read the business pages?"
"Not really,"
Bernstein admitted.
"I prefer to focus on the politicians, not the CEOs."
"And who do you think," Charlie asked, walking toward the door, "is telling those politicians what to do?" Chapter 22. Tuesday, April 20th, 1954. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Charlie exhaled one last satisfied breath to both begin the process of bringing down his heart rate and signal his immense satisfaction.
"Indeed," Margaret said.
Their clothes strewn about the living room, the couple lay naked on the couch. In the week since they returned from Maryland, they had been reconnecting, first as friends, now as husband and wife, her expanding abdomen no impediment. "Second trimester is a bit more fun," he observed.
"Hormones seem to be working for me, not against me now."
He stood and looked around the room for his underwear.
On the lampshade, darling, she said.
Only you could make that sound classy.
Will you get me a cigarette while you're up? They're in my purse, by the closet.
They'd had an early dinner, during which they'd talked about the baby. Margaret's appointment with the obstetrician earlier that day had gone well, and Charlie regaled her with tales of the more scandalous members of the House of Representatives. The sot whom the police had saved from drowning after he passed out in the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool. The senator who fancied himself a Lothario and who had hands like an octopus and the breath of a warthog. The young man who'd essentially inherited his congressional seat from his father, though the boy was so dense he could barely write his name in the sand with a stick. They'd laughed together for the first time in months. Now he lit cigarettes for both of them and handed one to her as she sat naked on the sofa. She reached for a throw pillow to cover herself, but he plunked down next to her and gently stopped her from doing so. She looked at him. He leaned in for another kiss.
I'm going to ask you to do something for me, she said.
What is it? Anything.
I want you to get the hell out of here, she said with a smile.
He didn't understand.
Charlie, ever since that night on Nanticoke Island, you've been wonderful.
She grasped his shoulders with a gentle squeeze, lowered her forehead to meet his, then pulled away and said,
But I must tell you, right now I feel exhausted, and I feel guilty.
Guilty?
Because I know you loved those poker games, and Renee told me there's another one tonight, even though it's Tuesday. I'm going to make some tea, read my book, and fall asleep almost certainly before you do. Why don't you go have fun? It will make me feel so much better.
And so it was that Charlie returned to Veterans Poker Night, only to learn that LaMontagne had become a regular attendee. He obviously wasn't an elected official, but as a veteran who seemingly had connections with every member of Congress, he had wormed his way into the group. Congressman, LaMontagne greeted him with a Cheshire cat grin, gleaming and pearly, everything else about him fading away. Charlie wondered if LaMontagne's handshake, firm to the point of pain, was meant to send a message. He faked a convivial enthusiasm as best he could, then looked around to see if anyone else had noticed LaMontagne's phony, hail fellow well met routine. No one had. In Washington, Charlie thought, insincerity was the air they breathed. It made him occasionally feel like Holden Caulfield, which in turn felt immature. LaMontagne leaned close to Charlie's ear. Listen, I spoke with Cohn and we may need you to do something with the Strongfellow dossier. Get it to the press. Do you know any national columnists? Charlie shook his head, more in wonder at the man's nerve than in response. In a room full of Charlie's fellow members of Congress, LaMontagne had just brought up one of the most sensitive subjects of his professional life and assigned him yet another unethical task. Moreover, he'd proceeded directly to the logistics of it all, bypassing whether or not Charlie was even willing. I don't know anyone, really, in the press. We'll talk, LaMontagne said confidently, patting Charlie on the shoulder. I have some ideas. Charlie grabbed LaMontagne's wrist and pulled him closer.
You said we need this favor. There's something that none of you have ever explained to me. Who is we?
LaMontagne smiled. In due time, he said. Senator Noland, he called jovially across the room. He winked at Charlie as he walked away. Charlie watched him and realized any escape he'd imagined for himself was just that, imaginary. He went to the bar cart and quickly downed a scotch.
Easy with those, soldier. Street appeared at his side. You don't want your poker judgment impaired.
Strongfellow turned on his radio, and Perry Como's voice came over the airwaves. A jury may find her guilty, but I'd forgive her if I could see. Two dozen veterans broke into small groups, and the room filled with the sounds of decanters clinking against the rims of tumblers and the fizzing of flat and cone-top beer cans being cracked open. Charlie sat with Street, and Strongfellow joined them and began dealing a traditional game of straight five-card poker. Weird not having Mac here, Charlie noted.
Yep, said Street.
Well, this is turning into a fun night, remarked Strongfellow. The other two chuckled. As long as we're being all serious-like, I had the weirdest run-in last week with Abner Lance.
Who?
Asked Street.
The Carlin aide, Charlie said.
That freaky Nosferatu-looking guy?
Asked Street.
Where?
Two cards.
Strongfellow replaced Street's cast-offs.
So there's a small town in my district, Skull Valley. 5 years ago, a pesticide plant opened up there and everything was fine, but maybe 6 months ago, thousands of sheep started dying.
No reason anyone could see. Ranchers just walked outside and found the entire herd was hooves up.
Jesus, said Charlie.
One of my staffers wrote to the Interior Secretary McKay to try to get some money for the ranchers and make sure it was safe for, you know, actual people to live nearby.
How many sheep total? Street asked.
6,000, Strongfellow said. Literally 6,000 dead sheep. We got a form letter back from Interior assuring us that we had no business inquiring any further. Saturday night, I was in Georgetown at a restaurant waiting for a table, and Abner Lance shows up out of nowhere and tells me to drop the matter.
To drop it? Charlie asked.
Yep.
That's madness, said Charlie.
Think about what they're manufacturing, said Street. A spray to kill millions of insects, a weapon to commit genocide against a species. So sheep dying is not surprising. My wife's family in Louisiana had to deal with something similar, with local chemical plants, and we had dead people there. Not sheep, but just colored folks, so who cares?
They sat silent until Charlie, to clear the air, took drink orders and headed for the bar cart, listening to the room's buzz about the tensions of the world.
All I'm saying is, if Eisenhower looks at Indochina and sees a row of dominoes, then what the hell is the USSR? A Mr. Potato Head? The metaphor is infantile.
Oppenheimer could well be a commie spy, but he built the bomb for us, so he might also be a pretty bad one.
Before McCarthy loved MacArthur, he was smearing him. Before he endorsed Ike, he was smearing him.
I'd give my left nut to have Palmer swing. He's going to kill when he goes pro.
If you're going to badmouth Hank Aaron, keep it down so you know who can't hear.
But it wasn't McCarthy who revoked Oppenheimer's clearance. It was Ike. That's my point.
You really think the Democrats can take the House back? You're drunk. We're going to be in power for a generation.
Charlie returned to the table to find LaMontagne in a fierce poker face-off with Street, Strongfellow having folded early. Street had learned the game Texas Hold'em from a fellow Tuskegee pilot from Dallas. He had made a second living playing cards during the war.
Trying to think of what you might have there to make you confident about this garbage flop, LaMontagne said, motioning generally to the three face-up cards in the middle of the table.
Street, expressionless, looked at LaMontagne. He didn't blink. LaMontagne smiled ear to ear. After a beat, he reached into his back pocket, withdrew his wallet, and removed a $10 bill.
Okay, Street, he said.
Street matched the $10 in the pot, then drew the fourth card in the string of shared cards, the turn card. Two of clubs.
Trash, said LaMontagne. As shitty as the Warren Court.
Street's eyes darted to LaMontagne's at the mention of the Supreme Court Chief Justice, who was expected to end segregation in public education any day now.
Oh, that's how to get your attention, said LaMontagne. Noted.
He reached into his billfold again.
You might not make much of that two of clubs, but I'm a man who gets good cards. You can ask anyone in this town.
He threw down another 10. Charlie wondered what Street had as his hole cards. It wasn't unimaginable that LaMontagne had, say, two queens or the king and ace of diamonds, and would be gifted with a jack of diamonds when the final or river card was revealed, leaving him with a winning straight flush. If LaMontagne was dealing, Charlie would indeed bet on that happening, and if he'd managed to get his greasy paws on the deck before Street began shuffling, who knew? Who knew if LaMontagne literally had an ace up his sleeve? Expressionless, Street met LaMontagne's 10 with 10 $1 bills that he pulled from a roll in his inside jacket pocket. Street tossed the river card from the top of the deck. It was the King of Diamonds. On the table, the flop, the 10, Queen, and King of Diamonds, the Two of Clubs, and the Three of Hearts. LaMontagne smirked with satisfaction. He took out the wad of cash lining his billfold and counted it.
120, he said, placing it all in the pot.
Charlie glanced at Street, who looked angry, even sulky, about getting himself into this spot.
Care to call? LaMontagne asked. I'm sure Charlie can spot you alone if you don't have the dough on you.
Charlie nodded, but Street, stony-faced, said calmly, I'm fine, thank you.
A personal check will be acceptable, assuming it's from a reputable bank, LaMontagne said.
But Street took the wad of cash in his pocket and proceeded to count it. Behind the ones were fives and tens, and quite quickly he plucked $120 from the pack, which left him with only two stray bills. He grudgingly threw them down on the table.
Call, Street said.
With exaggerated fastidiousness, his pinky extended, LaMontagne carefully revealed the first of his hole cards, the ace of diamonds. Combined with the ten and the queen and king of diamonds, there was a chance he had a royal flush. Then he revealed the second of his holes.
the Jack of Hearts. He had nothing. Street flipped his cards. Two kings. He had three kings, three of a kind, which certainly beat garbage. Charlie looked at Street, who was allowing himself to smile.
Jesus, I didn't see that coming, Charlie said.
You're not supposed to, Street said.
Too bad about that Jack of Hearts, Davis, Strongfellow said.
Fucking Jack of Hearts, the illegitimate son of the one true king, said LaMontagne good-naturedly, watching Street pick up the cash from the pot.
The illegitimate son, Charlie said to himself. Street shot him a questioning look.
Gentlemen, as delightful as this has been, I must bid you adieu.
LaMontagne stood, shook hands around the table, and made a beeline for the exit.
Nice bluffing, Isaiah, said Strongfellow.
The angry Negro, ruled by his emotions and unable to overcome his inferiority, Street said, counting his winnings. It's a role white folk are always casting black people in.
He sure left in a hurry, Strongfellow observed.
Not enough of a hurry, Street chuckled. Charlie stood up abruptly and turned to Strongfellow.
Can I use your office phone? Charlie had phoned his new friend Sneed, the junior librarian, and wasn't surprised to find him still at his desk after 9 p.m. After placing two other calls, Charlie walked back to the library, where Sneed opened the door of the Thomas Jefferson building to him, Margaret, and Cheryl Ann Bernstein.
Thanks for doing this, Charlie said, offering the librarian $10.
It's fine. I'm usually here late anyway, he said, rejecting the money.
Led by the librarian's flashlight, they made their way through the dark, empty halls of the enormous building, their steps echoing on the marble. Sneed took them down to the basement so they could walk underground to the Adams building, where the members-only room was.
Presumably, you're going to explain why we're here, honey, Margaret said.
I didn't get much of an explanation either, offered Bernstein.
We were playing poker, and Davis LaMontagne referred to a wrong-suited Jack as an illegitimate child of a king, Charlie told them as they walked briskly through the library.
That reminded me that when Franklin went to England, he learned of the existence of Temple Franklin, his illegitimate son's illegitimate son.
That's right, and he eventually took custody of him and brought him back to the colonies, Bernstein added.
His illegitimate son had an illegitimate son? Asked Margaret.
Some of the founding fathers took the term quite literally, Charlie said dryly. They had reached the special collections room in the Adams building, and now they stood aside while Sneed unlocked the door.
Some fascinating stuff in here, honey, Charlie said to his wife as they made their way across the cavernous room.
The contents of Lincoln's pockets the night of the assassination.
Spooky, Margaret said. That's what I said, Bernstein told her.
Sneed unlocked the door to the members-only collection and stood aside to let them pass.
We officially close at 10, but you can stay here until midnight, he said. I have to shut the whole library down then.
They waited for the door to close behind him. Bernstein thumbed through the photocopy she'd made of the collections binder, stopped, placed her finger on a page, and glanced up at Charlie.
So we're looking for Temple Franklin?
He nodded.
Because there's a file here under that name.
Chapter 23. Friday, June 5th, 1772. West Wycombe, England. Sir Francis Dashwood sent a special red gondola to collect Benjamin Franklin and other notables and whisk them up the Thames River to his estate in West Wycombe, 33 miles northwest of London. Franklin had no caretaker for his 10-year-old grandson, Temple, so he brought him along. Others from the elite class, the Earl of Sandwich, the Lord Mayor of London, Prime Minister Frederick North, and the Prince of Wales, brought sons and entourages of their own. Later in life, Temple would seek to fill in the blanks of his memories of the events there. It was from this attempt at a narrative that Cheryl Ann Bernstein now read, a 15-page description Temple Franklin had written recounting the experience, a mini-memoir. Charlie listened with rapt attention, and Margaret took notes. Benjamin Franklin, Temple's grandfather, had first met Dashwood through letters, literally and figuratively. As postmaster of the colonies, Franklin corresponded regularly with Dashwood, the postmaster general in London. After a few formal exchanges, as each learned more about the other, they began letting their guards down. Dashwood knew that Franklin was a Renaissance man and a font of innovation. Franklin knew that Dashwood was a man of great influence and power. Moreover, rumors had made their way across the pond about Dashwood's embrace of a life of debauchery and his secret club of the well-connected, where every desire was indulged.
This was the group that Dashwood called the Friars of St. Francis Wycombe, or the Medmenham Monks, what some in the upper classes referred to in whispers as the Hellfire Club. Their friendship blossomed during Franklin's visits to England, first in 1757 when he arrived as a diplomat representing the Pennsylvania General Assembly, then in 1764 when he came to petition the king to make Pennsylvania a royal commonwealth, though his stay stretched for years. Temple Franklin had memories of Dashwood greeting them all at the docks in June 1772 and informing them of the secret society's password, "Do what thou wilt." Afterward, Dashwood escorted him and his grandfather around the ornate grounds of what was once Medmenham Abbey, but now had been converted into something quite ungodly. A meticulously maintained garden revealed itself to be, from the top of a tower, an enormous representation of a naked woman, with milky water spurting from the red flowers on the tips of two mounds, and water pouring from a shrub, carved into a triangle. 10-year-old Temple Franklin laughed heartily at that one, as did his grandfather, a brilliant man who nonetheless found humor in the ribald and scatological. Other areas on the grounds hovered in Temple's fainter memories, ones that he later investigated as an adult. Dashwood had, in fact, had a cavern carved out of a hill. He jokingly called it the Cave of Trophonius, the architect of Apollo's temple, whose legendary mythical grotto was a place of nightmares. The den and everything about the estate was designed to provide pleasure, lust, and laughter, not fear. The garden grounds were crowded with sculptures of gods such as Venus and Hermes, with exaggerated emphasis on their more private parts. Over the entrance of the former abbey, the Medmenham monks, as they called themselves, carved their password in French, "Fais ce que voudras." On one side of the entrance stood a stone statue of the Roman goddess of silence, Angerona, while the Egyptian god of silence, Harpocrates, stood on the other side. Both held their fingers to their lips, urging visitors to keep all the secrets that they would soon witness and partake of. Inside the atrium hung 12 stained glass windows depicting the apostles in various obscene poses. In the opulent living room, a pornographic fresco had been painted on the ceiling. "Hospis negar si potis quod afferat," announced the carving above the entrance to the Roman room. "Stranger, refuse if you can what we have to offer." That room was crowded with silk-upholstered couches and decorated with paintings of naked, fornicating couples, many of them kings of England, disporting with notable contemporary prostitutes. Adjacent was a library devoted solely to books about either faith or copulation, from the Queen Anne Book of Common Prayer and Psalter to Fanny Hill, from the Quran to the Kama Sutra. Downstairs, a vast wine cellar abutted a pantry stocked with fine meats and freshly baked desserts. During his childhood visit, Temple Franklin was shipped off to the main Windham estate a few miles away with a teenage girl hired to mind him so he could be sheltered from the activities within the abbey. Only later, in his personal investigations, did he learn what his grandfather must have experienced. There were officially only 12 friars of St. Francis Wycombe, plus Dashwood, who in their mock religion was the Christ to their apostles. The abbot of the day selected the wines, arranged for the catering of the meals, and had first pick of the nuns available for coitus. As a guest, Franklin joined the 50 or so lesser members of the club who were permitted to participate in the revelry, though not the ceremony. The night that Temple Franklin missed, he later learned from one monk, was particularly drunken and debauched, an evening of pure urge and indulgence without restraint, not to mention blasphemous. A chapel ceremony was a dark and obscene parody of a Latin mass, with a toast to Satan and the powers of the world beneath. With incense burning and black candles casting a purplish light, cultists had approached the body of a lovely new young woman spread out on the altar and drunk sacrificial wine from her abdomen. From there, everyone proceeded to the Roman room, where Medmenham monks and friars could have their pick of various masked women dressed in nuns' habits. The women came from all over. There were prostitutes from London, of course, but friars and monks brought mistresses and girlfriends and even wives and sisters, and once a monk brought his stepmother. Local women would also join in the fun, enjoying the naughtiness under the cloak of anonymity and appreciating the opportunity to share intimacies with the elite and possibly even a member of the royal family. Couples or larger groups would use the couches, individual rooms, spots in the garden, and, of course, the Trophonius Cave.
The Hellfire Club was more than just a haven of depravity, Temple Franklin would write years later to his half-brother. It had tremendous social and business benefits. The bond of the shared illicit and secret experience was one aspect, but more powerful was the knowledge that you could ruin an ally with these secrets, and that he could do the same to you. It meant that one member would do almost anything for the others, because they would do the same for him. No one had a choice. Sir Francis Dashwood labored mightily to fund the colonies before the American Revolution, Temple noted. He did everything Ben Franklin wanted him to do. And Franklin was a great supporter of Dashwood's in every conceivable way. The flip side must have been true as well, Charlie realized as he listened to Bernstein. Members of the club were prevented from retaliating against one another, as they might have done otherwise, not unlike the modern geopolitical concept of mutually assured destruction. The men of the Hellfire Club were thus bound together forever. A member's secrets were safe, but only because everyone knew a betrayal would mean the indiscreet betrayer would soon see his secrets spilled as well. Which was not to say that the monks of the Hellfire Club of the 18th century all got along famously. Lord Mayor of London John Wilkes and John Montague, the 4th Earl of Sandwich, loathed each other. But they had to limit the damage they inflicted, since treading too far beyond an insult at a tavern might result in the full force and fury of the club striking them down. They were all to be protected. Temple Franklin mentioned pages who had disappeared after attempts at blackmail, and prostitutes whose pregnancies were taken care of via mysterious means.
So the Hellfire Club was about much more than pleasures, Margaret said. It was about alliances.
Oh my God, Charlie said.
What?
Asked Bernstein. Charlie gazed at Margaret and then at Bernstein. There's a Hellfire Club in Washington, D.C., today, and I went to one of its parties. He explained how many oddities he'd witnessed that night at Conrad Hilton's penthouse that had to have been traditions handed down from Sir Francis Dashwood's perverse clubhouse. From Strongfellow using the password, "Do what thou wilt," to gain entrance to the library, to the two small stone statues holding fingers to their lips outside its doors. There were far too many similarities for it to have been anything else. The engraving Hospis Negare Si Potis Quod Offerat, the stained glass portrayals of important men posed pornographically with naked women, the portraits of presidents and prostitutes. It was a 20th century version of what Temple Franklin described in West Wycombe, England.
Good Lord, Margaret said.
I don't know anything about this party, Bernstein said. It was last month, a wild affair, Charlie said. Everyone was there. McCarthy, Cohn, Carlin, the Kennedys, Strongfellow, Alan Dulles.
So you're saying they're all members of this deviant club? Bernstein asked.
Not necessarily, said Margaret, because Charlie's not a member and he was there. I assume most there weren't actual members. Just as in England, Ben Franklin wasn't a Medmenham monk, though he enjoyed a lesser affiliation in the club since he was trusted to keep his mouth shut. There were 12 monks, plus the Christ figure, right? Maybe it's the same here? I didn't even know what I had walked into.
Some of those guys must be monks, though, Margaret suggested.
Charlie massaged his temple, trying to recall details. The room Strongfellow knew the password to get into, the library. Maybe that was where the monks were? Carlin was there, and McCarthy, Whitney from General Kinetics, Dulles from the CIA, Sam Zemurray from United Fruit was there. They had the stained glass portraits and such, though I didn't recognize everyone in them, and to tell you the truth, I was pretty drunk and didn't really study them.
That's a lot of powerful people in that library, Bernstein said.
The three sat in silence, a ticking clock the only noise in the room.
Okay, this is now officially kind of scary, Margaret said.
Why? Asked Bernstein.
Charlie's getting a lot of pressure from this group to do whatever they want him to, Margaret said.
She squeezed the bridge of her nose and thought about the notes she'd made that night at Polly's lodging when Charlie had divulged everything. Pressure from a shadowy, powerful group. That was what Charlie was experiencing. And with what she knew about Van Wagenen and McLachlan, he likely was far from the first to have been so squeezed.
Well, it's a good thing La Montaigne called the Jack of Hearts the illegitimate son of the one true king,
Bernstein said, always looking for bright sides.
You had your brainstorm, and from there all I had to do was look under William.
Under William? Asked Charlie.
Under William Temple Franklin, she said. First I looked under Temple, but then I remembered that wasn't his actual first name.
Ah, right.
Charlie said.
Under William, Margaret said.
Yes, under William, Bernstein said.
Under William,
Margaret repeated almost to herself. Charlie looked at her expectantly. Yes? He asked.
She said, under William.
Right. What are you getting at?
Under Jennifer,
Margaret said.
Isn't that what McLachlan said to you? Under Jennifer?
Charlie and Bernstein registered what Margaret was suggesting, and then they sprang into action. Bernstein again opened the collection binder, found the listing for Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer, and pointed Charlie toward a vintage wooden file cabinet in the corner. Charlie opened the first drawer and began rifling through the papers.
There's one here under Daniel, but it's just a deed for some land, Charlie said, his voice sinking in disappointment.
He checked in the drawer again, more thoroughly. Nothing else.
Look under Jennifer, Margaret suggested. Under Jennifer. Isn't this collection in alphabetical order?
This file cabinet appears to be, Charlie said. In the second drawer he looked, he found James Madison, James Wilson, J, John, Jefferson, Thomas. Weird filing system, he muttered. And then he saw it, right after Jefferson, a crisp manila folder, unlike the mahogany-colored binders that held the rest of the collection. Hold on, he said. He removed a thick, new folder from the drawer, with McLaughlin's name written on it. Chapter 24. Wednesday, April 21st, 1954. Morning. Washington, D.C. and New York City. Charcoal thunderclouds darkened the skies above Washington, D.C. as Margaret pulled up to Union Station to drop off her husband. The McLaughlin dossier they'd discovered the previous night was tightly bound and tucked inside Charlie's briefcase, which she gripped as if it contained the nuclear codes. After the discovery of the folder, Charlie convinced Sneed to once more let them use the brand-new Halloyd Company photocopy prototype machine, the CopyFlow, reserved for Library of Congress staff, and they made two photocopies of the 98-page dossier, a process that took 2 hours. Margaret took one photocopy to hide in the house, and Cheryl Ann Bernstein had the other one, along with instructions to get it to Congressman Street first thing that morning. Charlie and Margaret had only the beginnings of a plan. They had information but no idea how to use it to extricate themselves from the tentacles of the Hellfire Club. They now knew that the errands Charlie ran for the Hellfire Club were trifling. However, what McLaughlin had discovered and diligently documented was shocking and consequential. They had come up with an idea to signal to the Hellfire Club that they were not willing to be pawns moved around on the chessboard any longer, and they surmised from Van Wagenen's example that Charlie needed to be at least somewhat public about it so as to cast a protective spotlight on himself. And more important than their own welfare, of course, was to begin to warn the world about what McLaughlin had discovered, which imperiled hundreds of thousands of innocent people, if not more. Before Charlie headed north to participate in the comic book hearings, inauspicious timing, but just the latest example of nothing being in their control, they had decided that Margaret would drive in Charlie's car to Susquehannock Island, where Gwinnett's team had relocated from Nanticoke. She would be busy there, and safe, with no one in the political world interested enough in her research to have any idea where she conducted it. Margaret kissed Charlie goodbye and wished him luck. The 7:30 morning congressional would get him into Manhattan with just enough time to make the noon hearing.
I want you to destroy comic books. I want you to be like Lex Luthor with a ray gun, just disintegrating superheroes.
Charlie grimaced. You laugh while I head to my doom. At least Cheryl Ann did some decent research. I have a good line of questioning that should get us where we want to go.
The world will be watching.
Please don't remind me. Charlie leaned across the seat to kiss Margaret goodbye one more time. Say hi to the ponies. After Charlie got out of the car, Margaret lightly honked the horn and exited onto Massachusetts Avenue, veering left toward Maryland to make her last research trip before their baby was born. Catherine Leopold had arranged for the Senate Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency hearings to be held at the Foley Square Courthouse, but Charlie wasn't aware until he walked through the door just how poorly suited the building was for the task. The courtroom was the largest one in the building, but it was a closet compared to most Senate hearing rooms. Desks had been jammed in at odd angles in order to accommodate everyone. Scattered throughout the room stood bulky television cameras. Their multiple power cords, thick as theater rope, converged like tentacles near the door before snaking down the hall.
Charlie spotted his place card on a side table alongside the subcommittee's counsel, staff director, and the court reporter recording the proceedings. At the center of the main table sat Senator Kefauver. He looked in his element, happy to be in the mix again 3 years after his successful crime hearings and 2 years after Democratic bosses stole the presidential nomination from him in a back room of the International Amphitheater in Chicago. On one side of him sat a fellow Democrat, Senator Tom Hennings of Missouri, and on the other side, the subcommittee chairman, New Jersey Republican Senator Bob Hendrickson. Hennings whispered something to Kefauver, who smiled and patted his arm collegially as the clock struck 12. A TV producer signaled to the senators as if he were a third base coach. A light atop the primary TV camera blinked on, and Hendrickson gavelled the proceedings to a start.
"This meeting will now be in order," Hendrickson harrumphed. "The United States Senate Subcommittee Investigating Juvenile Delinquency, of which I am the chairman, is going to consider the problem of horror and crime comic books. By comic books, we mean pamphlets illustrating stories depicting crimes or dealing with horror and sadism. We shall not be talking about the comic strips that appear daily in most of our newspapers."
Charlie hated congressional speak. It reeked of pomposity and self-importance and was utterly disconnected from how actual citizens talked. He'd observed its powers of intoxication. The longer a senator spoke, the more sure of himself he seemed to become. Hendrickson proceeded with long-winded bluster, assailing horror and crime comic books peddled to young people of impressionable age, while making certain to underline that the subcommittee fully understood the importance of freedom of the press. He was followed by the subcommittee's counsel, who took ample time to praise the chairman for his remarks before citing statistics that to Charlie proved nothing so much as a problem in search of someone to blame. Dr. Wortham was soon called to the witness table, where he made his earnest and angry presentation about the damage being done to his patients in Harlem and indeed all over New York City, no doubt throughout the United States of America. He was followed by other witnesses, all of them, it seemed to Charlie, associates of Wortham's or blue-haired types dead set on the need to eliminate any reading more fun than the cleaner parts of the New Testament. As in Wonderland, with the Queen of Hearts' demand of sentence first, verdict afterward, the initial part of the hearing was devoted to establishing as fact its premise. After the late and eventful night before, Charlie felt his eyelids weighing heavy. He made repeated efforts, some successful, to stifle yawns. After an hour, Hendrickson called for a 10-minute break, and Charlie stood, stretched, and headed for the restroom, where he ran into Kefauver.
"You have some questions for our witnesses, Charlie?"
"I do, sir," Charlie said. "My staff and I have been preparing. We think Danny Gaines would be a good witness for me to question, if that's okay with you."
"Wonderful," Kefauver said, zipping up. "Be ready for me to call on you."
Danny Gaines was called as the first witness, and from the very beginning he seemed a hostile one. After swearing to tell the truth, whole truth, and nothing but the truth, he identified himself as the CEO of IC Comics, which published gory tales of true crime and macabre stories of horror. He then offered the committee a host of snorts, derisive sighs, and exaggerated disapproving shakes of his head, while Hendrickson, with the help of enlarged copies of faded comic book pages, spent 20 minutes educating the room about how inappropriate IC Comics material was for the children who consumed it. Among the featured stories from the IC oeuvre, an adorable little girl kills her strict father and frames her mother, who is then sent to the electric chair. A priest uses candy to tempt children into a haunted house, where he murders them, after which their ghosts seek revenge in the most gruesome way. A man rapes and then chokes a woman to death on a rowboat, only to trip and drown after several vengeful frogs seek justice. Outraged Stemwinder concluded, Hendrickson turned to his witness with an arched eyebrow.
"Is there anything you can say, sir, to help us understand why your company believes this material is suitable for children?"
"You could ask the Brothers Grimm the same question," Gaines said. "Or Aesop. Or Walt Disney. The hag in Snow White is absolutely terrifying. Bambi's mom gets blown to bits. Dumbo is one of the most abjectly bigoted films I've ever seen. When are you hauling Mr. Disney before this august committee?"
"Surely, Mr. Gaines," Kefauver said, "you cannot be comparing Snow White with this comic book."
Kefauver held up Gruesome True Crime Suspense Stories, issue number 22, whose cover featured a woman's severed head held by its hair by a man wielding a machete.
"Do you think this is in good taste?"
Gaines tilted his head at an angle regarding the image.
For the cover of a horror comic book, it's in fine taste, he said. If we were aiming for bad taste, perhaps the murderer would be holding her head a touch higher, so that blood would be dripping more dramatically from her neck. Or maybe we could see more of her body, to see the blood